may have been formative too. Gives you, educated me into the importance of perspective and how things are perceived. When I was in the wedding in Pine Bluff, everybody was very nice to me. There was, of course, what you would expect, people being overly nice to you, but Faye and her family were just folks, and we got along fine. But the next lady next door wouldn't give me the time of day. She would speak to me, but sort of sharp, I mean, not sharp, but matter-of-factly, and never warmed up to me. And I like people to like me. So I puzzled about that, but I didn't say anything. And then 10 years later, I met Faye and Julius were in town here visiting their sister, and her husband ran into them, and they couldn't decide whether to tell me the story or not. But after we stayed over, the wedding was Saturday, we stayed over Saturday night and had a brunch, and then everybody scattered to all points of the compass, a big family affair. So after everybody had left and calm had settled down, Mrs. Robinson sat down with her neighbor and they started reviewing things and talked about how beautiful the bride looked and how what a wonderful catch her husband, the groom, had been and all that. And eventually they got down the list of ways, and Mrs. Robinson said, and Ted was awfully nice, wasn't he? And she said, humph. She said, he was an albino, wasn't he? He thought I was putting on airs, acting like a white person. For the only time I passed as black. It says something very profound, but I don't know what it is.
Was that your first trip to the South?
Well, except in the Navy.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And we ran into my home port was Norfolk, and we ran into a few local cultural things there. But anyway, where are we?
Well, I'd kind of like to just backtrack a little bit to
sure, good.
More when you were growing up. You said you were born in Champaign.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up there. Could you talk for a little bit about Champaign? You said you moved
to Urbana. They're twin cities, you know.
So was there a big difference in that move, or was it pretty?
Well, the only difference was that it was traumatic in the sense that you suddenly had to love everybody you'd hated and hate everybody you'd love, because the rivalry between the two towns, and particularly the two high schools, is very intense. But no, our family friends were scattered on both. But the history apartment tended to be in Urbana mostly, so we moved from. My father's closest colleague lived next door to us in Champaign, and he moved to Urbana first, and then we followed. Urbana was about 15,000, and Champaign about 30,000 at that time.
Now,
a one-industry town, of course.
One thing that I found very interesting is that you were mentioning your involvement with your church and your youth group.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about your experiences in the youth group in both high school or college, mm-hmm. maybe some interesting stories or how that helped to influence your thinking.
Well, it was an outlet for exploring social issues, you know, which became rampant in the 60s, but were, you know, grew up in the with the New Deal, there was a sense of, for the first time, the government cared about you, sort of thing. That they weren't just fine-tuning the machinery, they actually cared about the people. And that was novel. I remember the Depression only in the sense of, we never lacked anything. I mean, we ate regularly, and we never got very expensive presents. We never had very fancy clothes. We never drove a very fancy car. I do remember in 1937 when my father made full professor, my mother, it was the first time she ever just even alluded to finances in our household. She was so proud. She showed me the slip that showed that my father's salary had been raised to $5,000 a year. We were on, that was a very comfortable living. Now, so we were better off, and my father was never unemployed, as an awful lot of people were in those days. And as my father said, we got through the worst of the Depression, and then as things started getting better, the state budget got tighter and they cut our salaries. Illinois has always invested in the University of Illinois, and it's really one of the front rank institutions. It has the greatest college library of anybody in the country other than Harvard and Yale. And again, the librarian was a student of my grandfather's at Northwestern, so we were very close to them. And I dated his granddaughter. I dated in high school, but dating in those days was quite different than it is today. You know, you just did not entertain the thought of sex. Some of the guys might talk about it. You wondered what they were talking about. But everybody put on a brave front as if they knew what they were talking about. None of them did. The other thing I did in particularly the college youth group, with a college group, church group, was to write youth some theatricals, which were always parodies. I never had an original thought in my head, but certainly couldn't come up with a song. But we did, and most of them were political adaptations of Gilbert and Sullivan or something. And again, I got a lot of personal satisfaction out of being, you know, hailed as a very bright and creative person. You know, it's an exercise that again hones your writing skills. And words were always a big thing in our family. When my sister moved out and went to New York after she graduated, and I went to visit her, and I said, "Well, what was the first thing you appreciated about New York?" And she said, "Well, it's the first time I've gotten through a meal without somebody getting up to get a reference book." So it was a hothouse environment in the sense of academics. That's not very usual. But it was a small church. There were much bigger student groups at the Methodist and the Presbyterian student centers. Congregationalists were not a big force on campus. But we would put on programs and invite speakers, and I can't even remember what they were all about.
Was it particularly politically engaged group?
In the sense of talking about it, you know, we didn't man picket lines or campaign ringing doorbells or anything like that. But we all had opinions about things. Had one of the people in our church group was a guy who was an ecologist long before anybody had heard of the word. And I said, "What is an ecologist again?" He said, "It has to do with niches. Everything has, every form of life has an ecological niche." And he was very upset by the foreign policy of our government, which he viewed as not sufficiently left-wing, I think. And so he was at an ecological station in Minnesota, in a very remote area. There once. Then he couldn't stand American foreign policy, so he moved to Toronto, only to find that Canada was enthralled to Washington. And so he moved out to the western reaches of Canada, but that wasn't far enough. And so the next postcard we got from him was from New Zealand. And he said he'd finally found peace. And the guy that was a year ahead of me that had led me into the Navy, wrote him back saying he was certainly, it was wonderful he found peace at last, but he could not but help but note that he had landed in the one of two places on the face of the earth where racial exclusion was the official policy of the government. Anyway, we used to argue about the atom bomb and the morality of that a lot.
Were you the only one in your family that was involved, or were you?
Yeah. No, I don't know, my brother was involved in 100 things, but I don't. I was never. 4.5 years is a big difference at that age.
You said you had one brother and
one
sister?
And a sister in between.
Oh, okay. So you're. So
I'm
you're
the baby.
Okay. Well, what was it like being the youngest?
My brother resented the favoritism that seemed to him to be lavished on me. I didn't notice it myself. I did notice that occasionally at the dinner table I would start to say something and my brother would just keep talking or cut me off, and every once in a while my mother would interfere and stop and say, "Let him say what he wanted." And so in that sense, but my brother was very articulate, but what I did learn was that you marshal your thoughts and learn how to compress them into the most terse form you can, and then when they stop to breathe, you insert them quickly.
Good training for a legal professional.
Yes.
It sounds like you had exceedingly lively conversations at your family dinner table.
Yes. I took a friend down once from after I started practice here, whose parents were both doctors. He went to Reed College out in Portland. He was a very literate person. He had never seen an atmosphere like that. He was just bowled over. He just thought it probably must be the most wonderful way to grow up imaginable. On this issue of liberalism and views on things, sister, when she was in New York before she finally found the guy she did marry, was thinking seriously about marrying a Jewish guy. And so she called home and told mother about it. And she said, "Oh, that's very nice." So then Marty said, "Put Pop on the phone." We never called him anything other than Pop for reasons which are unclear. But and so he got on, and she said, you know this guy is Jewish, am I going to have any trouble from you out of that? He was somewhat taken aback. And he said, well, I know we want you to marry the person you want to marry. And she said, oh, well, I guess you were kidding about those, all those other things. Anything else?
Well, I guess in a similar vein, with activities and groups, you said you were a Boy Scout. Were you an active participant in that? How far along did you get?
I got as long. All right. I may have been a Life Scout. I know I got to be Star, but I never got to be Eagle. And I think the thing that stood in my way was Athletics Merit Badge, which was required for Eagle. Now, my friend, this good friend of mine, and I used to run the troop. We just sort of gravitated to. And if you've ever been in groups, you know there's a default position that occurs. Nobody wants to do anything, take any responsibilities. So we had good scoutmasters, but we would put together programs, and when we would have jamborees or something, we would plot how to, give a real thought to how to make it work. I mean, so our troop would look good. And Rollins' younger brother became Eagle Scout, and this other guy said, he always resented that. He said, Rollin did 100 times more for that troop than Jimmy ever did. We both laughed. That's not the point. We each did what we wanted to do.
Now, you said that athletics was one thing that stood in the way of attaining an Eagle Scout. Did you ever, because you couldn't play sports, did you have the desire to play, though? And did you at least follow sports?
I wistfully looked at the people who did, and I think I rationalized that I didn't want to.
Okay.
Because I couldn't. But even before I had the heart condition, I was skinny and awkward and weak, tall and gangly. I was 6 feet in high school, No, after you've had the experience, when you choose up sides to play baseball, you have the experience of being picked last time after time, that begins to send a message.
I'm sure that reflected somewhere else, when you look at, you were talking about the activity, the segregation and all that kind of ideology. It's kind of similar in there.
Yeah, being excluded, I resonated with that. I never thought of that. That's an interesting insight.
Now, you said you went to high school in Urbana, right? There was one high school there, or?
One in Urbana and one in Champaign.
Okay.
There are now more in Champaign, but I think there's still just one in Urbana, but a new one. The old Urbana High School is now the junior high school. The junior high school I went to fell into disrepair.
Did you have any teachers at the high school level that you found increasingly influential?
The rhetoric teacher, was a senior class and was noted for making valedictorians, people that would have good comparable grades going into it, and they were very stingy with A's. So I impressed my rhetoric teacher, and also learned to dissimulate. What is it? What's the polite word for lying? Anyway,
dissemble.
Dissembling. Yeah, dissembling. Once she had, one weekend I was supposed to write a, I don't know, a one-page essay on something, and the teacher always insisted she wanted our work papers submitted with it so she could see our thought processes as we got to wherever it was we got. And that weekend had been a busy weekend, and so Rollins' girlfriend sort of wrote my paper for me. Then I dutifully copied it over in my own handwriting and handed it in. And I didn't do that very often. I think that's the only time I ever tried that, because she said, after we handed them in, she said, you know you'll get no credit if you don't hand in your work papers. Well, that was a bit of a problem, because I hadn't, the work papers weren't in my handwriting. And so I went up to class and said, oh, I left home without them this morning. I'll bring them this afternoon. And by that I meant I left home without them written. But I, you and so I went home, and it was really a very interesting academic exercise. You might try it sometime, going backwards. Start with a finished product and try to constitute the fragments of the less artful ways you would have expressed this. So I justified it. It was a great learning experience. I don't think of myself as basically dishonest, no.
About being diagnosed with a heart condition, how is it that you could then join the Army?
Navy?
I'm sorry, yeah, the Navy. Yeah.
I wondered about that. Then I told them when I went in, they listened, said, there, y'all, we understand. 1A, you know, that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in the Great Lakes Hospital, I kept referring to it. It had been a heart murmur.
Uh-huh.
And we had an old family doctor, and I don't know if he knew anything about heart. And people said, did you have rheumatic fever? And I said, well, no, that was the one thing he said it was not. But I had just this feeling that my heart would stop beating at some point. And, but he said, you may outgrow it. And I don't know if I ever outgrew it, or whether I just, it became clear that it was not disabling in any way. I think, you know, nobody in the Navy was able to detect it. And until I was back in the scarlet fever ward, which I caught in the scarlet fever ward when I had the measles. What's a good place to catch scarlet fever? And I told that doctor about it, and he said, yeah, I can hear the heart murmur. I dutifully reported that to my parents, and my father said, oh dear. But nothing. Then I once accidentally saw my medical folder that travels with you, the record. It had one notation in it. The only thing the matter with this man's heart is he's nuts about it. So I took that as meaning I could forget about it.
Definitely something good out of the Navy. You were cured, I guess.
Yeah. Or it wasn't anything in the first place. The big thing was that I was in bed for 3 weeks and out of school for 6 weeks in my second semester, my sophomore year. And my sister used to bring home assignments for me, go around to the teachers and find out, and take my homework in, so I keep up. And the result of being in bed for 3 weeks was that when I came back to school, I'd grown an inch. I seem to have lengthened out lying down all that time. And again, no doctor since has ever been able to tell me whether what I went through was necessary or not. But that's just an epilogue. 5 years ago, I had a near-fatal heart attack. But I survived it by chance. That is, I happened to have it at home when I was within 5 minutes of the brand new Northwestern Hospital when I lived downtown. And timing is everything. It was a total blockage of the main heart artery. Got it started again and put an angioplasty on me. Been fine ever since. But it's the sort of thing that if you don't catch it then, you don't survive. But I have no clue that that had anything to do with what happened earlier. In fact, they said it was all diet and cholesterol and things like that. Do you want me to go ahead with some of the next phases, or what do you want? It's your.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit more, just before we go on to the next phases, about your time in the Navy. You mentioned some of the ports that you were at, mm-hmm. and particularly also about being in New York when the atomic bomb was dropped. Some of mm-hmm. those, sort of how you experienced the war.
Well, remotely. Because, of course, the war ended before I actually got in.
Mm-hmm.
I got my orders to report, and then the war ended, and then I reported.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was everybody breathed a sigh of relief, and everybody was going home, and demobilization was the big thing. But in the meantime, the people who ran the Navy knew that they were going to have a Navy when all this was over. So that's why they weren't interested in reserves. And then at that time, they wanted a commitment I was in for 3 years, 1 month, and 1 day as a result of my minority enlistment. But so it was all, we were, when I was on board ship, we were developing anti-submarine tactics, and we operated out of Key West, and we would go out with a destroyer screen, and then a submarine would try to penetrate that. And the question was whether our detection equipment was good enough and our routines were good enough, whether our flyers could then go bomb it or whatever it is you're supposed to do with it. Or the destroyers zip in and drop their depth charges, whatever you do. Because they were concerned about submarine warfare. And these little destroyers would look like corks bopping around. Of course, I was on a fairly big thing, and in the 18 months I was on board the ship, I was only seasick for the first 12. Means I didn't think I had a career in the Navy. And I can't imagine what would have happened to me on one of those little ships. But it was a very light compliment. That is, it was not a full crew because it was peacetime, so it was a nice. And you know, we got our liberty regularly. And oh, one of the things that happened was that if you go to electronic school, they make you a second-class petty officer when you graduate. You start, instead of being a seaman or a seaman first class, you start the school as a petty officer third class, and when you graduate, you're petty officer second class, which, you know, in the pecking order is of some note. You get aboard ship, and those rank ratings mean something. In school, everybody has them, so you don't even think about them. And so the officers used to think that that meant I should be able to exercise leadership, and they would put me in charge of things. And I didn't know how to do this, and people were very kind. I was working on a piece of equipment, and I said to the guy I was working with, "Will you go up to the next deck and get this thing for me?" He said, "No, you can get it just as easily yourself." I said, "Oh, okay." So I went up and got it. And then afterwards, he explained to me the purpose of rank is so that you, where it's necessary for you to delegate something, you do it. But if you can do it just as easily, we're not your servants. And, you know, he made a very interesting distinction there. Mm-hmm. And one guy sort of, I was chided for not exercising adequate leadership, and so I tried once, and I actually shouted at one of the guys in my division, and one of my friends said, "Yeah, he overheard some of the other guys saying, 'Oh, did you hear that boot petty officer try to chew the guy out?' They thought I did it very badly." So I decided that my stereotypes of leadership were wide of the mark. And, you know, I got out, my last column in the ship's newspaper, as I was leaving the ship, I was bidding farewell. I'd been writing it for a year or so. I referred to my departure as my interwar leave between this war and the next one, or the last one and the next one. I mean, yeah, so anyway, you get the picture. And of course, I got out in 48. My sister and I took a trip to Europe in 50, summer of 50, and a war broke out while we were there. We had vowed we were going to read only French newspapers. When the war started, we said it was a noble idea, but we also want to know what's going on. So you read the Paris edition of the Herald Tribune while you're there. Mm-hmm.
Was that your first trip to Europe?
Yeah.
It must have been interesting to be there in the immediate post-war years.
Yeah, it was. We took the whole summer. It was like 6 weeks at least. And it cost us $1,000 apiece, including passage. Yeah. I mean, these numbers don't mean anything, of course, because you can't put yourself back in. Although even then it was very, I mean, mm-hmm. Most people would spend a lot more to take that sort of trip. Mm-hmm.
You said that you wrote for your ship newspaper in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first foray into journalism?
Well, let's see. No, I wrote a column in the high school newspaper occasionally. I remember writing an editorial about the Battle of Iwo Jima, and I have no idea what I said or what I even knew, but you know, I would, but it was original. And the teacher who was the sponsor of the program said she sent it to one of her friends and said, "That's the most sane thing I've seen written about that." I mean, that's all nonsense, of course, but it made you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
No, I enjoy writing, and I enjoy tearing apart other people's writing. My colleagues here work for me, you know, eventually get used to the idea they'll work and work and work on a memo or a letter or something, and then they'll come back with measles. Everything's red all over it. But,
Nowadays, they take a lot of legal writing in law school. Did you have legal writing at Harvard?
No.
So how did you learn how to write legally?
Reading and writing. Listening to my parents speak. You know, you get a feel for what doesn't sound right. And if you're fortunate enough to grow up in a family where what doesn't sound right isn't right, you're way ahead of the game. If you grow up in a family where what you hear every day is wrong, well, then you have a terrible burden to overcome. You know, everything I have and achieve, I see as, practically an outright gift. You know, I worked, but, I would never have done anything that I've done without all the advantages that were just heaped on me. Which is also what I was taught as a good Protestant. Well, interrupt any time. And whenever you decide you have to quit, that's fine with me. The clerkship, I got some understanding there. When I would write memos, I thought they were very well written, and the judge the first couple of times said, "Oh, that's very nice. Now here's the way you have to recast this so that, first place, you have to consider who your audience is. You're talking, there'll be a three-judge panel. There were 9 judges on the D.C. Circuit, and they would rotate, so you never knew which judges you would get. You've got to get their attention. You've got to tell them what you're telling them. And you have to make your points up front. And, just one little dinky little trick that I never tumbled to. I was arguing with Judge Bazelon, who was sort of a boy wonder out of Chicago, and he viewed his intellect as very high, and would let you know it. But I was arguing with him on a justifying a position. He said that's wrong. I said no. I said cases all say thus and thus and thus and so, except this, and I was prepared to distinguish it. When he interrupted me before I got to the except, he said, "That's clearly false. Here, what about this case?" I said, "If you read the rest of this, no, we shouldn't have to read the rest of the sentence. You should put that up front, so that nobody can, reading something is not accurate, it creates an impression. And if you protect yourself by qualifying it before you get to the, then you can make a much stronger point." But anyway, I resented it at the time. But my judge then, who died at the end of the year I was there, he had pancreatic cancer, but went very quickly at the end. But before that, he had given me a list of 6 law firms in Chicago that I could apply to. He thought they were good firms.
Now, had you always had the desire to come back to Chicago?
Oh, yeah, I wanted to come back to the Midwest, and I wanted to go to the metropolis of the Midwest, and that's Chicago. And a very easy choice. Between my second and third year, I clerked for Thompson, Hine, and Flory in Cleveland, which is Cleveland-based. It wasn't a worldwide empire back then. I did it because I'd never seen the inside of a law firm, and I thought maybe I ought to do that before I got to my third year of law school. And so it was a good experience. And one of their guys came to Washington on something, he asked me if I would be interested. Seemed a little disheartened that I had never had any intention of, because they were very nice to me. I always wanted to come back to the Midwest.
What was the appeal to the Midwest? Just
my roots, this is where I'm at home. I talk Midwest. And I resent Bush or Nixon telling me what Middle America is all about. It's not those right-wing Christians, I'll tell you that. Clerkship we dealt with. Now I interviewed all six firms. It didn't occur to me to interview anybody else or to ask anybody else. And so I got two offers, one from what was then Jenner and Block, I think. It was something else back then, and Bell Boyd, which was then Bell Boyd and Marshall, which went by the trade name of Bell Book and Candle, which was a popular book at that time. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And because Justice Stevens had been a friend of Tom Marshall, who was the marshal of the firm. It then soon morphed into Bell Boyd, Marshall, and Lloyd, and then went through a lot of other manifestations and finally settled down into Bell Boyd and Lloyd now, all of whom are dead, of course. But I'm sure I spoke to Tom Marshall when I came. He was a gruff litigator. And but he would never chat with me in the hall. And the only way I figured out that he knew even who I was that we were standing alone in the elevator lobby outside our office, and the elevator didn't come, and even he got a little squirmy about not saying anything. So without looking at me and staring at the floor, he said, "So Harold Stevens is dead." And I said, "Yes," and gave him some of the particulars of it. That's not your usual warm greeting. He had a secretary who was once called to testify in court about the mailing of a notice, because that became an issue in the trial. So they put her on as a witness that that's what she'd done. So she went to court, sat through the court proceeding, came back and resigned. She said, "He was so nice in court. He doesn't have to be the way he is here. He's a son of a bitch here. He can be perfectly charming." So there's a lesson. I've always tried to be nice to my staff. Anyway, I gravitated to, we used to protest, I got in the real estate department because that's where I was assigned. You know, when you get in the law firm, you know, where they need you is where you go. And this may determine your career, no matter what you think. And so one of the things that the guy who was immediately ahead of me in the hiring order had handled was the gathering up of people's tax bills and shipping them over to the other law firm that protested the taxes. And so he passed that on to me as something he thought I could do. And so I had that connection with real estate taxes, but mostly it was other things, and I had a very nice boss. But after 5 years, I came in 55, in 1960, Dan Ward was elected state's attorney. Well, back up to my political science course in college. I had a Professor Neer was the big name in political science. He was a very short guy named Shorty Neer, not by his mother, but he was prominent in the field. He was lecturing to a room full of well over 100 people and called on No, he asked a question. He said, no, he called on somebody and said, he cited something that had happened in the municipal government that you were studying at the moment. And he said, why do you suppose that happened? And he turned around to write something on the blackboard, and the guy said, oh, it's all politics. And Charlie Muir turned around, and I mean, he whirled and stared the guy down and said, you know what's the matter with politics in this country? The guy was a little bewildered, didn't know what to say. He said, it's because people like you won't go into it, so you get exactly what you deserve. So I decided right then that was what I would have to do, was go into politics. He said, it was a challenge. So when I came to Chicago, one of the first things I did was look up my ward committee money.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't going to have anything to do with those independents. I wanted the real machine, so I worked for Claude Holman, who was the 4th Ward committeeman. Mm-hmm. I thought I was in the 5th Ward because that's where Hyde Park is usually identified with. But, so I was a machine precinct captain for 10 years. All the time I was working at Bell Boyd and then at the state's attorney's office.
And how did you know, if you wanted to get involved in politics, to immediately find out who your ward
was? You look it up on a map and then look in a phone book and walk in.
Sure, but were you familiar with sort of the machine style of politics and who
well,
you
Well, I heard
to know?
Legends about it, most of which were wrong, but we just interviewed Judge Jordan yesterday,
mm-hmm.
who was also out of the 4th Ward, and whose start was as my assistant precinct captain, as a matter of fact. But he had gone to Len Dupre, who was the 5th Ward alderman and head of the IBI faction of the Democratic Party. And he had, Michael Jordan had gone to him and asked, you know, if he wanted to get into politics too, and said, well, this is what the independents are doing here. And he said, well, no, I want to get into party politics. He said, well, you're in the 4th Ward. He said, Marshall Korshak's all right, but and you can go do what you want for him, but you're a resident of the 4th Ward. Your committeeman is Claude Holman, and, you know, he won't give you the time of day. You know, he's an 80% black ward, and he doesn't have any use for white precinct captains, you know. Won't even talk to you, probably. He'll talk to some assistant or something. And so Michael went to see him and found out everything that Len told him was wrong. And the odd thing is that Len knew that I was a precinct cat. I know Len and have known him for a long time. And I had good things to say about Claude, but it was ideological with him. He thought, well, only independent Democrats could maintain their integrity or something like that. But anyway, I walked in and he said, where do you live? And I told him, I said, do you know what precinct that is? I can't remember whether I had taken the precaution of looking it up, and I may have said no. He pointed to a map and said, well, you're in the 33rd precinct or whatever it was. He said, you want to be a precinct captain? We don't have one there. Okay. So I walk in off the street and I'm a precinct captain. And of course I'm employed, so I don't ask him for a job. Come the first big election, we're all required to come through and tell him exactly how our precinct is going to vote. We'll be graded on that. And then he says, well, how much money do you need? I'm puzzled. Well, how much do you pay your workers and the judges and, you know, the election judges, and you know, you have to buy food, you have to get the coffee and donuts, and, you know, you have expenses. And the policeman expects something too, you know. I said, well, you know, whatever it is, I'll take care of it. And so he always called mine a free precinct. I learned the first election day when the policeman came up to me and said, now I know Claude gives you money. And I said, no, this is a free precinct. He said, what? I've never heard of such a thing. So we interacted to sort of learn each other's. He thought for 5 years I was a spy for the IBI. He finally decided I was for real. And I blazed a trail for Michael Jordan, who then ended up as president of the Ward Organization, among other things, and actually was instrumental in seeing that Tim Evans was his successor when Claude died very suddenly. I just learned that yesterday. But anyway, so I was given a precinct, and I worked very hard at it. I was still single at the time.
What sort of things did you do for the precinct?
Well, you canvass. You go meet everybody. You go ring doorbells. You learn. You put out literature. I designed my own literature because I didn't think the party literature, I would attach the party literature, but it was so. I used to put out a newsletter. It was called the Democratic Doorbell Ringer for the 33rd. It was a very catchy. And I would cut the stencils, but then I'd take them over to headquarters. I'd at least use his office to run the. And he apparently had never had anybody like quite like that. And so eventually, though, after my 6 years with Bell Boyd, when I wanted to go into the state's attorney's office, I went to him, and he was, you know, happy to have me. The thing I think that puzzled him more than anything else was that for a while he treated me with kid gloves, but, you know, occasionally you do something that displeased him, and he would really ream me out just like anybody else. And I think he was impressed that I would accept that as of course, that's what I don't want to be treated any different than anybody else. So he eventually made me president of the Young Democrats, which is where I met people like Harold Washington and John Strozier and all those guys. John and I have an agreement that we'll admit to being in the Young Democrats together, but never how long ago that was. So that was sort of the beginning of my real political career. I was interested in Adlai's campaign, but I was off at law school at the time. But my hero was really Harry Truman. That was my idea of what a president ought to be. Still my opinion that he's the last president we had that decided things on the basis of right and wrong rather than focus groups. Anyway, so I did all this real estate tax work and was happy with it. In the 60 election, I was surprised to see that the chairman of the lawyers committee for Dan Ward. Again, they'd lost the state's attorney's office 4 years before to Ben Adamowski, who had switched sides and become a Republican, and he had spent most of the intervening 4 years indicting all of Daley's friends, so we wanted the office back. Adamowski also earned the record for having the most indictments dismissed. I mean, he would do it just for the show of it, for the fun of it, as it were. But anyway, the chairman of the lawyers committee, I was surprised to see, was Laird Bell, who was my senior partner. Now, Laird Bell was distinctive among senior partners in big firms in that he was a Democrat. You had to go down on our letterhead a long way before you came to the second one. So when I got this idea, well, now that, they brought in a blue ribbon candidate, as it were, and they took Dan Ward out of he was dean of DePaul Law School at the time, so made an excellent choice. Ran a good campaign and got elected, and, you know, working in his office was a real joy because he was very professional. And when I got there, when he interviewed me, he said, what sort of an assignment were you looking for? And I said, well, I don't know anything about the various things the state's attorney does, but the one thing I do know is I want to be assigned to the criminal division. He said, okay, I see. So I never saw the criminal division. He knew a lot more than I did. He assigned me the civil division and put me in a desk that said tax expert on it. And so I became a tax expert. And everything crossed my desk, and I was the only person there to do it. And, you know, I some of the things that my predecessor explained to me, and he always held himself out to be willing to help if there were any questions arose. But then new things would come up. I would say, well, how did my predecessor handle these? And they'd say, oh, he didn't. We couldn't proceed along these lines. Nobody knew how to do anything on it. So I created my own office, as it were. I used to accuse my friends of leaving handwritten notes on the walls of the bathroom saying, if you have a problem that nobody else can solve, go see Swain in the state's attorney's office. I could get the most remarkable lineup of people problems. So I learned my tax law there, and my first big case was the railroad cases. I established my reputation by handling the case where the county suffered the largest civil judgment in its history, $40 million tax refund. So, but, you know, the railroads were right, of course, but that's beside the point. Actually, we won at the trial level, and in the course of it, the case we put together, you know, it had to do with how you value railroads. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to all these cases I'd done on my paper in law school, and they were all right there, and I used most of them in our brief, but the Supreme Court, I learned something else, two things out of that experience. One was that they had already decided a downstate case in which they had granted relief to the railroads in a very modest amount, and so the downstate counties that were involved were stuck with the judgment. So Cook County comes along, and well, a lot more is at stake, but to think that they were going to say to the downstate counties, you lose, but they will decide differently for them just because they know what they're talking about is fanciful. The second thing I learned was that as I was cleaning out the file drawer about the case, I found a folder that said correspondence. There was only one piece of correspondence in it, saying it was a letter from an exchange of letters from the state's attorney in these counties that had first been hit, saying this, the state's attorney of Cook County, who was Ben Adamowski at the time, this case has implications for all of us. Why don't we pool our resources and attack it and really put up a defense to it? And Adamowski wrote back a nice letter saying, thank you very much. I appreciate your concern. We'll certainly get back to you. And that was all it was in all the correspondence there was. So it could have been nipped in the bud earlier. Whether it would have produced a different result, I don't know. But I learned a lot about tax policy. Do you want to go home or something? It's 3:10. You're entitled.
Well, we thought that perhaps we should. This would be a place that we could stop now.
Yeah. Okay.
And then in our next meeting, pick up with the start of your
public career.
Yeah. And that's sort of a nice place to start
yeah,
in our
yeah.
next conversation.
Sounds good.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah.